Okay, good afternoon. Welcome back. I hope you had a good lunch and are charged for a full afternoon session. My name is John Crist. I'm with the Fellowship Program here at the Institute, and I will serve as the moderator for this next panel and the afternoon's discussion on Bridging the Divide. This panel features a cross-section of practitioner-oriented projects led by experts here at the Institute who work with parties in conflicts throughout the Muslim world and other parts of the world to promote dialogue, education, negotiation, and other nonviolent options for building alliances among so-called adversaries across the lines of conflict in the various settings in which they have experience. We will move on down the table with the presentations and begin with David Smock, who is Vice President of the Center for Mediation and Conflict Resolution and head of the Religion and Peacemaking Program here at the Institute. He'll he'll make some general observations and discuss in particular his experiences leading interfaith dialogue processes involving Muslims and other clerics. Next to him is Qamar al-Huda, Senior Program Officer with the Religion and Peacemaking Program, who will summarize his research on the pivotal position of American Muslim groups in brokering relations between the U.S. and other publics in Muslim-majority societies around the world. And then we'll hear from Jeff Helsing, Deputy Director of the Education Program, report on his work developing curriculum and source material for teaching peace and tolerance in classrooms in divided societies, particularly in the Israeli-Palestinian school systems. And then finally, we'll hear from Eugene Martin, Executive Director of the Philippine Facilitation Project, who will reflect on his role as an observer and facilitator in the negotiation process between the government of the Republic of the Philippines and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. So it's a packed panel, but a very interesting one, and I will turn it over to David Smock to get us started.
Thank you, John. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the earlier session, so I hope that nothing that I say will be repeating what others' points have already made. The press is filled with acrimony and conflict between the Muslim world and the West, quite apart from the terrorist attacks. Most recently, obviously, is the Pope's speech in Germany, earlier the Danish cartoons. The divisions are deep and the misunderstandings are widespread. But we need to ask ourselves, what is the nature of the divide? Is it really religious? Or is religion a surrogate for other issues relating to social and national identity? The reactions to the Pope's speech are, to some degree, about religious beliefs. But even in this case, the sensitivity on the part of Muslims to the speech and the nature of the reaction relate to a whole host of other issues, including the Arab-Israeli conflict, the war in Iraq, Guantanamo, a whole host of events and activities that generate on the part of many Muslims that the Muslim world is under attack, quite apart from whether Islam is under attack. But beyond the acrimony and hostility, there is a widespread hunger, both on the part of many in the Muslim world and many in the West, for dialogue and engagement, both in this country and internationally. And we have been privileged to have opportunities to learn about this and to be participants in some of it. We will be publishing next year a book on interfaith dialogue in the Middle East, authored by Muhammad Abu Nimr and two other co-authors, focusing on Israel-Palestine, on Jordan, on Lebanon, on Egypt, and documenting, assessing the extent to which there is, and it's very extensive, interfaith dialogue between Christians and Muslims, and in the case of Israel, Jews, in the Middle East. A couple years ago, we published a piece works entitled Healing the Holy Land by Yehezkel Landau, talking about the extensive interfaith activities in Israel and Palestine, many of which people just generally don't know about. One of my favorites is an activity that took place a couple of, like 2.5 years ago, when a number of Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians, having heard Israeli Jews talk so much about the Holocaust and how Palestinians don't understand the Holocaust and how the Holocaust is related to the need for a Jewish state in the Middle East. And these Palestinians said, we need to learn more about the Holocaust. And it asked a group of Israeli Jews to accompany them to Auschwitz. And they went together, a large group, and it had an enormous impact on all the participants, and that impact spilled over to others in both communities. We sponsored interfaith dialogue here and training on interfaith dialogue, and we have some publications on the Abrahamic Trialogue. We have been developing a training course on interfaith dialogue and how to engage in interfaith dialogue. We had a trial run here in July, and we'll eventually be putting it on our website so that internationally people can download it and take this course on how to undertake interfaith dialogue. There are handouts on the table of some of our learnings, and I have a book entitled Interfaith Dialogue and Peacebuilding. We have witnessed and supported interfaith peacebuilding in Iraq, in Nigeria, in Sudan, in Macedonia, in Israel, Palestine, and those are described in this piece works called Religious Contributions to Peacemaking, which is available free of charge. Let me just mention a recent series of activities in Sudan that are not covered in this publication, but we've been working with two Sudanese organizations, the Sudan Interreligious Council in Khartoum and Reconcile, which is a southern Sudanese predominantly Christian organization. We co-sponsored a conference a little over a year ago in Khartoum, the most important gathering of Christian and Muslim leaders in recent memory in Sudan, to talk about how religious leaders can reinforce the implementation of the North-South Peace Agreement. And more recently, we have co-sponsored a series of activities by Christian and Muslim leaders to go to all of Sudan's hotspots, and there are many of them. Darfur was the first, to work with local Muslim and Christian leaders to develop their capabilities as local peacemakers and as promoters of reconciliation, working on an interfaith basis. It's been a very exciting project to be part of. We've also witnessed a hunger for learning about the religious other. We've seen across this country increased enrollments among Christians to study Islam and to study Arabic. Churches, mosques, and synagogues have been wanting to learn more about the other faith. We had a workshop here last year on teaching about the religious other, and we brought people from institutions, from colleges, universities in this country, and from other parts of the world who are experts on teaching about the religious other, to share their experiences on how it can be done most effectively. And we put out a publication that's available called Teaching About the Religious Other. And through grants, we have financed work on teaching about the religious other in Bosnia, in Serbia, and in Bulgaria. And we work with the Arab Group for Muslim-Christian Dialogue. They held a conference a little over a year ago in Amman, Jordan, for representatives from all the Arab world to talk about teaching about the religious other and how institutions in the Middle East can do that more effectively. Some of you may know tomorrow we have an event with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to talk about her new book, The Mighty and the Almighty, in which she recognizes and concedes the shortcomings of the Clinton administration when she was Secretary of State in recognizing the importance of religion as a factor in international affairs, and she'll be talking about that tomorrow. Tom Farr, who previously headed the office in the State Department on international religious freedom, has a book that will be coming out soon that Oxford will be publishing, talking about his experiences in the U.S. government dealing with religion internationally and highlighting the shortcomings of the American approach to religion and understanding religions in other parts of the world and dealing with religious leaders. There's lots to be said about the nature of effective interfaith dialogue, but we had an experience here that I think highlights a couple of important lessons. We hosted a delegation of 5 religious scholars from Saudi Arabia, and we had full control of their program, of the agenda, who they would meet. So I set up a week-long series of activities, including a day-long session with Christian leaders, a day-long session with Jewish leaders, a day-long session with American Muslim leaders. And the many ways the Christian dialogue was the least effective, because particularly the liberal Christians were so eager to make nice and understand each other and reach out and embrace the Saudis that they never really got around to the tough issues. It was only an evangelical Christian who was present who said, let's cut out the crap and get down to the issues here. And by far the most successful of the dialogues was between the Saudi scholars and the Jewish leaders, most of whom were Orthodox rabbis. And they got down to the issues right away on both sides in a very civil manner. And they asked the tough questions, each side posing the tough questions for the other. And out of that experience, I think, highlights the fact that it's just fine to sit down and talk to the religious other and make nice and say we love you and we understand you and there aren't really any significant differences between us. But that's wasting an opportunity if you don't talk about the tough issues and come to a deeper level of understanding and hopefully shape the thinking of the other side as well. One final comment. We co-hosted last year a delegation of 9 religious leaders from Iran. One Jew who has a reserved seat in the Iranian parliament, one Christian archbishop, and 7 Shiite leaders. And what was remarkable about that visit was the extent to which we were able to discuss the really tough issues that divide this country and Iran in a nominally religious context, meeting with religious leaders, even going to Capitol Hill. The Iranians did not want to go to congressional offices, but they were prepared to meet in the Congressional Prayer Breakfast House and meet with 9 members of Congress and the Senate to talk about the nuclear issues and all the other tough issues, but it was done in a religious context. And I think there's learning in that for many of us about what can be discussed with some societies in a religious context that's more difficult to do in a strictly secular one. Thank you.
Well, next we'll turn to Kamar Al-Huda.
Thank you. Good afternoon. What I'd like to do in addressing bridging the divide question is exactly how are Muslims in the United States and in Europe working in this effort, and how various Muslim communities are a part of this make up Muslims in the West. And one or two sort of disclaimers. When we speak about Muslims, first and foremost, sometimes we only see them as just religious beings. For the most part, Muslims in Europe and in the States from the 60s and 70s were the most secular of secular species. Communists and Baathists on the run, and opposition folks in Europe. So, and they had anything to talk about religion or Islam was sort of a waste of time. It's amazing to see in 30 years that the same people we speak about Muslims in the West are now predominantly have a religious identity. Not all, but that's what I want to start with, that when we do speak about Muslims, let's do remember that there are a whole set of non-religious folks who fall into this kettle of fish. Approximately 25 million Muslims live in Europe and North America. They, of course, are amalgamation of immigrants, second generation, third generation, indigenous converts, and so forth. And as you can assume, there's a great diversity of professions, class, ethnicities, and practices of Islam. And that's the other disclaimer that I'd like to insert in here, that when we're speaking about Muslims, that the diversity of Muslims is incredible, not only within Sunni Islam or Shia Islam, but also the Sufi or mystical way. And so it's almost difficult in 8 minutes to speak about this diversity and how they work and they cooperate or they don't cooperate. But one thing I do see in a pattern of the behavior in the past 10 to 12 years is a more of a viewing themselves as ambassadors to Middle East societies, mainly because of these societies are in conflict or in turmoil, and you see more Western Muslims, if I can use that term, see themselves as ambassadors as a way to bridge conversations, to bridge interfaith dialogue, to bridge greater intercultural, interreligious understanding. But let me also add that from what my study is, there's a big contrast between European Muslims, and I use that term loosely, and American Muslims. In the European context, we find that it's mostly an immigrant community in England, in France, Germany, and so forth, Italy. And they have their whole set of different issues of assimilation, of integrating themselves, of mobility, social mobility, of access to higher education, and so forth. Their concerns is compounded with sort of the cultural issues that they not only bring with themselves to the new promised land, but also the cultural issues that are asked of them to adopt and integrate into their new identity. So they see contradictions as a in living as a Muslim in England. Some of them do. Again, I'm speaking about some most recent. But I might say that American Muslims have a different kettle of fish. They are very keen of seeing themselves as Western, and they don't see themselves and have any contradictory identities as being a Muslim or living in the States. This is from an MPAC, a special report. MPAC, I'll bring them up, is a Muslim Public Affairs Council special report of 2005, who said about 75% of Muslims see no problem in living here and being Muslims and being westernized and living in Western society. The other 25%, it goes on to discuss the various issues. We find that in Europe, European Muslims are finding questions and holding on to various issues as what is true Islam and how this true Islam can be lived in a society that is not a theocratic society or Islamic society. And these actual conversations are very lively in the mosque. You don't have those conversations in American Muslims mosques. In fact, the questions in the United States in American Muslim mosques or institutions are far from theocracy or from the issue of assimilation, but their issues are more about education, business networking, cultural institutions, establishing political institutions, lobbying efforts in D.C., increasing lobbying efforts. And for those immigrants who are here, worried about their children's education and children's future. Many of this sounds like it's a no-brainer, but it's very true. But there is a major contrast between American Muslim communities and European communities. On one hand, in Europe, assimilation, integration is at the sort of the forefront of their of who they are, what they see themselves. And one of the things I found is that in France, the Muslims, even after attaining a certain amount of education, of professional status, there was always some sort of grievance. And I think there's this ideology of grievances that I found in the work. Whereas, because even after a professional, there was always a ceiling for French Muslims. And these are people who've been second generation, who've been raised there and speak fluent French and so forth. We have in the United States a completely different idea of civic responsibility, of creating institutions, and those institutions are responsible to the particular community, and also being very involved with political participation. So in the diversity of American Muslim organizations, bringing Sunni, Shia, or Sufi, or within a zillion different sects within this group, they provide a vast number of voices addressing many issues of terrorism and democracy and peace building and human rights. One of the things that they see is that the pluralism of the United States and the pluralism within the American Muslim community adds to their own diversity of views, and they don't see those diversity as contradictory to Islamic values. But, you know, things have changed after 9/11 for a lot of us. In a few minutes. Not everything is as rosy and perky. You know, since the special registration program, the Patriot Act, and other programs, we had about 15,000 Muslims, American Muslims, deported because of some technical issue of their holding, not having a green card or so. We have a number of racist incidents and racial profiles and so forth. So we do have a cadre of folks who are quite moving towards this ideology of grievance, of being ill-treated. Not extremist thinking, but I think of being ill-treated and feeling that the civil rights have been violated, and vast majority of Americans are willing to have this civil rights violated, and if not tolerated. I do want to leave a note on a very important event that happened 3 weeks ago. The largest Muslim American organization in the United States, based in Indiana, I believe, Islamic Society of North America, had elected a woman to be president. She's a professor at Hartford Seminary, Dr. Ingrid Mattson. And this is not only a major reflection of sort of how American Muslims view the future, but also the priorities of interfaith dialogue, the priorities of being involved with civic duties and being involved with overseas issues. If anyone knows Dr. Mattson, she's very involved with overseas justice issues and conflict resolution issues. I'll stop here, and I hope to answer any questions afterwards. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kumar. And Jeff Helzen, please.
Good afternoon. My goal in the next 10 minutes is to both make a case for the importance of focusing on education in promoting peace and bridging the divide, and giving you a sense of some of the projects and work that we have done primarily in the Palestinian-Israeli context. Too often, over the past, education has been ignored as a significant factor in peace building. With some exceptions, education is rarely, if ever, an important component of a peace agreement. In most peace agreements, it's not mentioned at all. It's only in the past few years has really any attention or resources been paid to education. In some cases, this is because of the realization of the value of educating refugees, internally displaced persons, and those affected by complex humanitarian emergencies. So international agencies are now putting more emphasis on the importance of education. There's a realization that through education, one can reduce incidences of conflict and violence. In addition, providing resources for education gets societies or gets people or gets refugees focused on the future. It gives them hope. It's an investment in their children, which in clear terms is an investment in the future. So we are seeing more and more emphasis on education as a critical component of post-conflict reconstruction. But there's also a realization that education can play a role in conflict prevention and a role in the process of conflict resolution. There are those, just like Madeleine Albright, has come to the realization that there was an inadequate emphasis on religion during the Clinton administration. There are those who also were strongly involved in the peace process, the Oslo process between Israelis and Palestinians, who recognized that there was not enough attention paid to elements in the society that would be critical to providing an atmosphere that would support the ongoing political process. And so a great deal of inciting behavior came from religious institutions or leaders, from the press, and also within the schools. And that was partly due to the curriculum in the schools, the textbooks in the schools, but there was no reinforcing sense of peace and understanding the other in the educational systems or educational processes. Secondly, there's been a long-standing focus on what is, and sort of what the topic of my talk was, teaching peace and tolerance through education. And there's this assumption that much of what is done in education, particularly as it relates to peace, is a promotion of and a teaching of tolerance. In fact, in the last couple of years, the term tolerance is being discarded. Because tolerance, particularly for people in conflict, particularly for people who are trying to bridge a divide between them, tolerance implies often that you simply put up with, you tolerate the other. There's no effort necessarily to understand the other, to put yourself in the other's shoes. It also is seen as a way in which the status quo is simply reinforced. We'll tolerate each other. We don't kill each other. We don't necessarily try to understand each other. But there's simply no dealing with the issues that divide people. And so part of the emphasis of our programs has been to find a way to promote education that will help bridge divide between people. Prior in the Israeli-Palestinian context, prior to the advent of the second or current intifada, there were a lot of different groups, or there were a lot of different exchanges or processes which promoted sort of interaction between Palestinians and Israelis, that promoted meeting the other. And most of them not only failed to prevent the subsequent violence, but once the violence began, they just sort of faded away. They were viewed as failures. And in large part, that is because they had no function. There was nothing to, in a sense, find common ground and help people work on bridging the divide. It was simply a meeting place. And once again, was seen as a way that simply reinforced the status quo. Well, aren't we liberal and open-minded because we meet with each other? But very little is accomplished. So the work we've done in the field of education has been two different emphases. The first is to help bridge a divide by finding functional, working, sustainable projects among educators. And we've done this in three areas. The first has been in teaching or promoting good teaching tools and good teaching practices, bringing Israeli and Palestinian teachers together to share their experiences in the classroom, to develop a litany of best practices. And in some cases, this is done around a common discipline, but also dealing with common issues in the classroom, such as how do you deal with controversial issues? How do you deal with the trauma of the ongoing conflict and violence that spills over into the classroom among young, impressionable students? So this finds a way in which there are teachers who can work together, not to find or come up with some agreed political solution, not simply to meet with each other, but to find some way they can work together as teachers to promote better teaching and to work for the betterment of their students. And there they have a common goal. So an organization that we've worked with over the years, the Middle East Children's Association, has been working together, meeting against all odds. And they have amongst their ranks close to 250 Israeli and Palestinian teachers who have survived threats of violence, gone through checkpoints, find ways to meet together, despite the disparagement sometimes of their colleagues, their friends, their family, and they meet as teachers. And they struggle with each other. They don't agree on everything. If they discuss political issues, or if they discuss the wall, if they discuss violence, if they discuss the settlements, if they discuss Zionism, it's a real struggle. But these are issues that emerge in their classrooms. So how can they find a way to deal with the controversy, to deal with issues that their own students have to wrestle with? And they work not to agree with each other on the political issues, but to find ways in which they can, by coming up with common educational activities, common curricular activities, common teaching practices, and sharing that with each other, they find ways of promoting a better understanding of each other. So an Israeli teacher that is working with Palestinian teachers, and these Palestinian teachers are not just, you know, those who are the most open-minded, Western-oriented teachers, but include those who clearly have sympathies with Hamas, are very religious, come from refugee schools, not necessarily elite schools. And so Israeli teachers can return and talk to their students about real people, real Palestinians, who have real and oftentimes common emotions or concerns as teachers, parents, and human beings. We have continued to work with other projects, particularly around the issue of teaching about and discussing history, a critical issue both in the classroom and between the two societies. There's a very interesting project that's developed one book promoted by two organizations, Panorama, a Palestinian one, and Yakar, an Israeli one, and it's around shared narratives and shared histories. And what it really does is investigate where there are differences between Palestinians and Israelis and how they look at different periods of history, different incidences of history in a different way. Understanding the other and getting that kind of dialogue can in fact help bridge a divide. Two of the historians involved in that project are now teaching a joint course at Hebrew University, a Palestinian and an Israeli teaching about their history and providing the different perspectives. There is another organization, the Peace Research Institute in the Middle East, that has developed a very interesting set of history texts for secondary school students in which they have on one half of a page the Israeli narrative, on the other half of a facing page the Palestinian narrative, and then they have a blank space in the middle, which is also a way of, you know, thinking visually about bridging the divide. Are there common areas in which students can find about the history that they have gone through together? We find that this functional cooperation has succeeded in retaining the relationships and working together as teachers and educators. The Paris Center in Israel has promoted an interesting project in which theater pieces are have been developed by a joint Israeli-Palestinian group of actors and directors. And they have taken these theater pieces into Palestinian and Israeli schools. Where we were helpful was actually helping them make them more educational. That is, they just presented these things to students without any preparation, without debriefing them, and to make these really resonate more and to help them reinforce the lessons of the theater pieces that promote understanding of the other, there really need to be very good pedagogical and teaching tools that can be used to do so. The second part of what we do, though, in helping to bridge the divide, is a recognition that not only in the political sphere or the security sphere is there a tremendous power imbalance, but there also is in the social and educational sphere. That it is difficult sometimes for educators from the Palestinian schools meeting with the Israeli educators because the resources they have and the educational background they have may be vastly disproportional. So we've worked a lot on helping to build up the educational capacity in the Palestinian Authority, helping to develop curriculum, books and materials on anti-hate or anti-bias. We have a project that's just about finished in which a series of activities and flashcards for young elementary school students on religious symbols is being developed to put into the classrooms to expand young people's acquaintance with other religions. In addition, we have worked at providing skills on conflict resolution, nonviolence, human rights for teachers and students in Palestinian schools. One of the most interesting projects we did was a series of training workshops for student council leaders of all the West Bank universities, in which we taught them conflict resolution, nonviolence, and leadership skills. And interestingly enough, we said before these workshops began, the issue of Israel is off the table. This is about Palestinian skills. And they found that they had lots of internal conflicts in schools with authority, with administrators, between political factions who were, in fact, coming onto campuses and fomenting dissent and violence. So the development of those skills has been very important. And we hear and have seen some evidence that student activism is both increased, is more coordinated and networked, but has also, in the last year, become more nonviolent. And again, it's a way of developing a leadership cadre that ultimately is going to be better skilled and trained in dealing with Israelis. The last thing I will say, and I'm going to end on a rather negative note, and that is, to bridge the divide, one has to have the capability of actually going across the divide. And the wall, or the separation barrier, is making this very, very difficult. So we are now turning our attention, and those of you who want to support this education, but also greater interaction between Palestinians and Israelis might want to consider, as we have done, the need to electronically find ways of getting contact and communication between people who, for the political situation, are unable to do so without incredible difficulty and perhaps not at all, as the wall continues to be completed. And therefore isolating Palestinians and Israelis who are trying to work to bridge this divide. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you, Jay. And finally, we'll go to a very different part of the world and hear about the Philippines from Gene Martin.
Thanks, John. Good afternoon. I am delighted to be here this afternoon to address issues related to Islamic communities in Southeast Asia, which is a major component of global Muslim Ummah. Too often, Americans believe Muslims in West Africa and North Africa, on West Asia and North Africa, represent and speak for all Muslims throughout the world. There are quite different, many differences between Southeast Asian Muslims and those in other parts of the rest of Asia. They have varied experiences and varied perspectives on global issues. Unless we recognize their differences and listen to them, we risk forcing them into what I would call the Arabist Islamic mindset. So it's very important that we keep a perspective on different outlooks around the world. The Institute has worked for over 3 years to help the Philippine government and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, the MILF, in the southern Philippines to bridge the historical divide between the majority Christian and the minority Muslim populations in an effort to end an over 30-year conflict. Our engagement was initiated at the request by a request to President Bush from the leaders of the Philippine government and the MILF for U.S. help in facilitating the peace process. When I began my work in this project, my Moro contacts said that since the Moro territories had been incorporated into the Philippine nation by U.S. colonial authorities, despite Moro pleas to be allowed to regain their independence, which had been taken from them by U.S. military prowess, that it was up to me, representing the U.S., to solve the conflict, to solve the problem. While the U.S. government seeks to address threats from militant groups such as Abu Sayyaf and Jamaa Islamiyah elements in the southern Philippines through counterterrorist training for the armed forces of the Philippines, the Institute of Peace has worked on the margins of the negotiations, which are conducted in Malaysia with the excellent support of the Malaysian government, to help the two sides address the underlying causes of the conflict. The two sides have reached agreement on the need for economic development in Moro areas, which are the poorest in the Philippines, and have implemented a ceasefire to essentially end the fighting, thanks again to an effective Malaysian-led international monitoring team. The unresolved issue is ancestral domain, which includes devolution of political and economic authority to a Bangsa Moro homeland juridical entity, while matters of governance and control over natural resources appear to have been settled in the talks. The talks have been deadlocked over the territorial extent of the Moro homeland, particularly how the prospective juridical entity will govern non-contiguous Moro communities in non-Muslim areas. Drawing upon the various programs within the Institute, the experts and the expertise that we have here in the Institute, we have focused our efforts in three areas. We have researched and held workshops on international precedents on ancestral domain issues to help the negotiators find ways to overcome political obstacles to an agreement. Many other countries have wrestled with similar problems, and their successes and failures provide valuable lessons to the parties. Secondly, we have conducted programs to strengthen the constituency for peace among majority non-Muslim populations of the Philippines by reducing historical misunderstandings, prejudice, and discrimination against the Moro minority by working through education, religious dialogue, and the media. Third, since much of the conflict and the violence in the Moro areas is within and between Muslim communities, Moro communities, and ethno-linguistic groups as part of the community, the Institute has sought to bring young leaders from diverse communities together to explore common interests and goals to counter internal strife. If the negotiators are able to reach an agreement on the territorial extent of the Bangsa Moro homeland, honest and consistent implementation by both parties will be critical to resolution of this long conflict. International, particularly U.S. engagement during the implementation period, which could be lengthy, is essential since previous government of the Philippines moral agreements have foundered because of inadequate follow-through. If the U.S. is seen to be willing and able to assist the Muslim community in the Philippines to obtain redress for past and present grievances, it could be a powerful step in our efforts to build bridges over the divide between the Western and Muslim worlds. So what are the lessons learned from our Philippine experience? First, I would say it's the importance of establishing trust with both parties. This has been particularly difficult with the MILF, partly because the U.S. has an alliance with the Philippine government. We have focused on military engagement in our war on terrorism. USIP, however, has been able to cut through this through careful nonpartisan engagement. We are separate from the U.S. government, but we have been able to show the U.S. interest in a peace agreement. Secondly, we have added value by drawing on outside expertise and experiences which relate to the situation in the southern Philippines. Third, lessons learned are the focus is to focus on basic causes of the conflict: prejudice, intolerance, discrimination. It's important to keep in mind the historical record. And last, we need the need for an international engagement to hold both sides to their commitments, to encourage, yes, even to pressure both sides to keep talking and not give up when they reach obstacles which seem insurmountable. It will take a long-term commitment. This is not something that can be done in short order, because we're talking about changes in political and economic power relationships, and this is always very difficult to get people to change. These are some of the lessons we have learned in our 3.5 years of trying to bridge the divide. Thank you.
Great. I want to thank the panel for some very interesting comments, and I hope they'll be very fruitful for some discussion and questions and answers during the next 20 minutes or half an hour or so. As it has been the case earlier in the day, we have microphones on either side of the room, so I encourage those of you with comments or questions to come up to the microphone and ask those as appropriate. I guess I'll take the chair's prerogative and ask the first question, and I suppose it's for the whole panel, but probably in particular David Smock and Jeff Helsing, and it has to do with the question of the dialogue groups. And I know from listening to advocates of dialogue in a variety of different contexts as they've come through the Institute and other places, they of course grapple continually with the with two important problems, potential critiques of dialogue processes or other sorts of intervention along these lines. And that is the question of selection problems, because there are often critiques lodged that the people that participate in these sorts of groups are the folks most prone to encouraging dialogue in the first place. And secondly, there's the question of how to sustain the changed perceptions that arise in these sessions in context outside of the temporary gatherings that in which this kind of dialogue is promoted. And I just wondered whether it would be interesting to hear your reflections on how you would see your work addressing those kinds of issues, trying to draw out the impact of these efforts beyond the confines of the particular group itself.
Well, those are critical issues, and I do, in the handouts on the table out there, I do try to address some of these. The selection issue is centrally important. Those that are inclined toward dialogue are more likely to be understanding, to be open to hearing what the other side is saying. The extremists in all religious communities are much less inclined, sometimes feel it's impossible to engage in a dialogue with the religious other that would somehow violate their own religious convictions or corrupt their community to engage in dialogue, so that those that most need dialogue are usually the ones who will not participate in it. It's critically important to reach out and stretch in the selection process, not just have self-selection, but reach to the people that have influence in the wider margins of the religious community. So it's not just a self-selected group of the already convinced and committed, but those that can learn and be more opened by the process and have an influence beyond the circle of the committed. But that's a continual challenge, as is the challenge of sustaining dialogue. And a one-off dialogue is rarely very effective. There are too many issues to deal with. It's too hard to sustain the impact, even though it might be a feel-good experience one time around. And dialogue doesn't really achieve anything, as I was suggesting in my comments, unless it touches on the hard issues, often the justice issues. It isn't just a matter of understanding the theology of another group, but understanding the political, social, economic, and religious issues that divide them, and hopefully come up with an agenda where religious groups joining across religious divides can jointly engage in efforts to promote social justice and develop a common agenda for achieving common goals. That's where the real impact comes.
Thank you. Jeff, do you care to comment?
Yeah. What we've done is a little bit different, as I alluded to in my comments. We aren't promoting dialogue groups. We're promoting working groups. And the success to that in the selection issue is to have very good local partners. The United States Institute of Peace, for me personally, is going to be able to go in and reach into those communities, those schools, or find people who can really make a difference. And so one has to be do a lot of work in determining how well one's local partner can reach people who are not sort of the usual suspects. And so in many ways, my experience has been that we often have had Israelis and Palestinians who join these groups to become better teachers, to understand the other, but have never met each other before, have never met a Palestinian who actually lived in the occupied territories, or had met an Israeli other than a soldier they had encountered at a checkpoint. And so it's tapping into those sectors of the society who both have the ability to influence many young people, but aren't those who have had access to such programs in the past, we find can make a big difference. And secondly, the issue about hard issues that David raised, I think that's also important. And you don't avoid the hard issues. You have to address them. But I've been rather amazed at, as teachers have become more familiar with each other and the ones we've worked, they now feel ready and have begun to and have developed curriculum around the hard issues. So Israeli and Palestinian teachers have developed activities and curriculum on the law. What do you teach about it in both sectors? Also around the role of religion and Hamas. Again, both of these are controversial, but how do you deal with these? And you have to help them develop the skills to do it in a way that has educational value. So it's not just you develop activities, but you help them develop a process of evaluation of what works in the classroom, what impact they're having. So you have to invest a lot in the pedagogy, that is, in the process, in the teaching side of it. The other thing that has been done, which I have found rather interesting, is you don't just bring in, you know, history teachers or social studies teachers, but in fact there's a very interesting group of math teachers that's been supported by the European Union who are finding ways to, in their math activities, sort of get rid of stereotypes and promote issues related to peace. So you don't use examples that reek of violence, or you don't stereotype the other, but you can teach math in a way that's reinforcing what's being done in other disciplines as well.
Thank you. We had a question here on the side. Please identify yourself and your affiliation.
I'm Santanina Rasul from Southern Philippines. Mr. Moderator, with your kind indulgence, I will not ask a question, but I want to provide an answer to this second issue, and I will share with you ringside observations to justify my answer. The second issue this afternoon was, can Muslim Americans bridge the U.S. Muslim world divide? My answer, definitely a very, very strong affirmative. Yes, you can. There is an entity here in Washington, based in Washington, D.C. It's called the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. This is composed of Muslim Americans. I mean, maybe first generation, maybe some of them second generation Americans. And my daughter and I, we had occasion to witness, you know, to listen to the lectures of this. Dr. Masmoudi was one of them, I remember. And we were so profoundly affected, you know. And I told my daughter, I think we need to have lecturers like these people come to the Philippines and talk to the Muslims, because these scholars, they are actually academicians, but they have studied the Quran for 10 years, 15 years, and any question relating to Islam, they can answer, and very eloquently. Because in our case, when we talk to our Muslim brothers in the South, you know, especially when we are dealing with the ulama, you know, we have not studied the Quran the way these scholars did, so we can only give some perfunctory answer. But with scholars like the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, like Dr. Masmoudi, they can, they can answer in a very nice way and very convincingly, and they quote from the Quran. And so what happened was, when two lecturers, I think supported by your embassy, and I think IP, the two scholars were sent to the Philippines to lecture, to talk about Islam and democracy. Not only were the Muslims, even the non-Muslims, they were really impressed. And so they were brought, they lectured not just in Manila, in the academic institutions, they were brought to the heart of the insurgency. They were brought to Sambuanga, they were brought to Cotabato, and shall I say, they wowed. In quotation marks. They wowed the audience so much so that even the dinner that we hosted for them, you know, the people, they wanted to listen some more. They wanted to listen to Muslim Americans. And so, and not only that, the impact of it was so tremendous. There is now a council, Philippine Council for Islam and Democracy. This is an offshoot of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy here in Washington, D.C., and the Philippine Council for Islam and Democracy has been organizing roundtable discussions, and I think Dr. David Smack was one of the guests of this PCID. And not only that, it has been instrumental in bringing in academicians, political leaders, Muslim leaders from all over Southeast Asia, particularly Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand. And there is a move for this network to expand so that there will be a council for Islam and democracy in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in Thailand, in Singapore. So I think definitely Muslim Americans, you can bridge the divide with the Muslim world, but send the right people. People who are knowledgeable in Islam, because they will really, the Muslims, they can always see through. And I don't think I could tell you more, but I don't want to, you know.
Well,
I think there are others who would want to ask questions. But definitely, we need people like those Center for Islamic Democracy. Dr. Masmoudi, and I remember Dr. Safi. There were two of them who went to the Philippines.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Anyone care to react? Any other questions or comments? Well, perhaps, unless there are any other comments to be made by the panel, I think that we'll take advantage of the fact that we finished a little early to give you all a stretch break, and we'll reconvene at 2:30 for the next session on pivotal conflicts in the Muslim world. So thank you all for coming.